My favorite hour of the week is right now. Dr. Aaron Carroll joins us, and my job becomes far easier because, boy, is he a yapper. Talk with the good doctor. But he does make good points. He is succinct. He is the professor of pediatrics at the director of Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. And I'll be joining him in Indiana, in his home, for 3 days because I'm headlining Morty's Comedy Joint in Indianapolis, and I'm going to stay with him. So that's none of your business. You don't need to know what we're going to be doing, what we're going to be up to. But we're going to have a lot of fun, and I hope that you'll come to the shows at Morty's Comedy Joint. Dr. Carroll's going to join him. And I feel bad, Dr. Carroll, because I didn't realize that this was Passover week when I booked the gig and the trip and said I'm going to come to you. Isn't there a big Seder Friday night that you should be attending rather than my show? I feel bad.
No, Seders were Monday and last night, two nights. They're over.
There's no tradition for Friday night?
Well, Sabbath? I mean, the sort of the dietary restrictions still sort of exist, but no, there's no. No.
All right. So that wasn't a weird thing for me to just, because if you're not religious, if you're not Christian or Jewish,
it makes, like, the eating
you forget.
Different, but I don't think you'll notice or care. So we'll be fine.
Are you going to be feeding me on the Sabbath?
Friday.
Or are we going out?
I imagine we will. We'll figure something out.
We're going to go to that Asian fusion place we went with all your wealthy hoity-toity doctor friends?
I think yes, ironically. So maybe. We'll see.
I don't know.
Whatever Amy has planned, I do what I'm told.
There's a lot to talk about with the good doctor, and as always, we want you to join the conversation. The phone number is 866-994-6343. He only joins us to get followers on Twitter. It's the sole reason. His Twitter handle is at Aaron E. Carroll. He's written two books debunking medical myths. He's also blogs at The Incidental Economist, and now at The New York Times, he's a contributor to their Upshot section at the newyorktimes.com. Okay, let's start. I think that the thing that probably annoys you the most, sir, is that people attribute health care, health policy, health insurance trends to the Affordable Care Act, the raise in premiums, doctors wanting to kill themselves. There's so many things that we're made aware of for the first time since the Affordable Care Act passed. And it's Obamacare's fault that these things are happening. But just because we've learned of them for the first time doesn't mean they haven't been going on for a long, long time, these trends that have been occurring. That seems to be something that really you debunk a lot, a myth that really bothers you quite a bit.
Well, it's one of those where it's impossible to understand still at this point sort of what is because of the Affordable Care Act and what is just true and unrelated. And it just amazes me how and again, it depends. Pick your side, because there's hypocrisy all over the place here. But when good things happen, you know, people will be like, oh, that has nothing to do with it. That has nothing to do with it. You know, but when bad things happen, it's, oh, this is entirely due to it. And granted, some people do exactly the opposite. But, you know, healthcare spending has been much lower in the last few years than almost ever before. A lot of people want to attribute that to the Affordable Care Act. I'm a bit skeptical. But on the other hand, you know, when some people's insurance premium goes up, a lot of people want to attribute that to the Affordable Care Act. I'm sort of skeptical because a lot of the things we're seeing have not gone into effect yet. The Affordable Care Act, remember, just kicked in with respect to the exchanges and a lot of the regulations just a few months ago. So, you know, everyone freaking out with some of the changes, it's very hard to attribute that to the Affordable Care Act. Now, of course, if you were never able to get a policy before, now you can because you can buy one on the exchange. That's pretty much because of the Affordable Care Act. And if you got Medicaid when you never had it before because they, you know, broadened it and expanded the program, that's the Affordable Care Act. And if your 25-year-old can now get on your plan and they could not before, that's the Affordable Care Act. So some things you can say are the Affordable Care Act, but a lot of the noise about, you know, this happened or that happened, and, you know, it's because a lot of that is just noise. It's just people trying to blame something bad or alternatively something good on a law that probably doesn't have the effect yet on the whole system that people are attributing it to.
This week we heard reports that the Congressional Budget Office is saying the Affordable Care Act is going to get even more affordable.
Yep.
The most expensive provisions of Obamacare will cost taxpayers about $100 billion less than expected. The CBO also said it doesn't expect big premium increases next year for insurance plans sold through the healthcare laws exchanges.
Yep.
And in its latest analysis, CBO said the law's coverage provisions, a narrow part of the law that includes only certain policies, will cost the government $36 billion this year, which is $5 billion less than the CBO's previous estimate. Over the next decade, provisions will cost about $1.4 trillion, roughly $104 billion less than the CBO last estimated. Sometimes giant government programs, in this case benefits, come in under budget, come in less than projected. There are a lot of metrics here that we can talk about, but that was the case with Medicare Part D. We've got enough time that's passed since we can analyze this. But Dr. Carroll, this is all attributed. This, all these savings that are being reported, I think, without doing any research at all, are probably attributed to the fact that the Medicaid expansion was not accepted by 25 states.
That is part of it. But parts of it are also that, you know, it turns out that a lot of the premiums cost on the exchanges cost less than people expected, which meant the subsidies cost less. And it turns out that, you know, employer insurance seems to have gone up more than people expect. And that makes it cost less for the law because that means more is coming from jobs. And the rate of increase of healthcare spending has gone up less than people expected, which means that a lot of the projections are less than they thought. So there's a lot of reasons why it is, but in the same way that Medicare Part D was. I mean, I can give you a list of reasons why people think Medicare Part D was less than people expected as well. Sometimes you can't predict the future. This is what we said at the beginning years ago. Sometimes everybody said the CBO is lying, the CBO always underestimates. That's not true. Sometimes the CBO comes over budget, and the CBO underestimates and things cost more than they do. Sometimes the CBO overestimates. Things wind up costing less than they do. But they try to put their projection where they think the most likely outcome is. And in this case, the way the world is and the things that have happened have made it actually look like it's going to cost less over time than people had originally predicted, which, of course, is terrible news if you hate the Affordable Care Act and want to prove that it's going to destroy everything, because it turns out it's going to cost less than we thought.
Here's Melanie Starling's last tweet. Now, hashtag stand up with at Pete Dominic, at New York Times contributor, and at Incidentally Economist blogger, Dr. at Aaron E. Carroll, takes your health policy questions, 866-994-6343, a perfectly written tweet, except for the third L.
Oh, yay, that's right. That's why I didn't see it at first. Yes, you spelled my name wrong.
The third L, Aaron Carroll, CarrollL.
Yeah, I wonder who that is.
Wow. Really? Hairless. Wow. Really, really unprofessional, ma'am.
Nice.
Miss.
Miss?
What were you thinking? I mean, this is the only reason he comes is for Twitter followers, and you add an L. I would never make a mistake on a tweet myself. I reread them a number of times before I would ever put that out there. You got to be more careful, young lady. Follow my lead.
Bam.
There it is. I see it fixed now.
All right. So there's a ton to talk about with you today. Just mentioned some of it there. The other big kind of controversial story is something to do with the census. And I explain this the way that only you can, sir.
So it's not a delay. So the census, this one is complicated. And this one actually irks me. And I know that I'm differing from a lot of other people on this one. But the census for years has sort of asked a few questions about insurance. And because the census has to be standardized, the question's not perfect. No question is perfect. It basically says, have you had insurance in the last year? It's supposed to say, have you been uninsured for a full year? That's what the census is supposed to measure. And it's been doing it for a long time. And every year in August, when you know they come out and they say the number of uninsured is 49 million or 47 million or 50 million, it's from the census and the CPS surveys. And that is where a lot of the metrics for tracking uninsurance over time have come from. Well, everybody knows the questions are imperfect. In 2005, there was published a reasonably good review of this by the government talking about all the different surveys and ways that they measure the uninsured and what their pros and cons are. But the best one for tracking nationally the number of uninsured for a long period of time has always been the CPS. Well, a couple years ago, they added some questions to start doing better state-level tracking on a different survey. I think it's called the ACS. And then that was started in 2008. And so if you want to look at state-level trends, that's the one you look at, and it asks slightly different questions. Well, they decided, I guess, over time, they wanted to change the CPS questions to make them better, to make them more accurate, also because they want to be able to pick up stuff like what's going on in the exchanges and how are things going. So they announced yesterday that they are changing the CPS questions in order to be able to sort of get new metrics. But because they're changing the questions, they're going to be different. And they expect that actually they will pick up a smaller number of uninsured because of the ways that they've, I guess, modeled the questions or the ways that they've trialed them. So they announced yesterday that because they're changing the questions, they will not be able to compare any data they pick up from now going forward to what has been in the past. So that means that they'll have like 2013 data with the new questions, but nothing from before that we can track. Now that irks me because, it would have been really nice to been able to sort of watch year to year changes with standardized validated questions to see how did the Affordable Care Act change the number of uninsured nationally. And now we won't be able to do that with the CPS survey, which is the biggest of its kind. So we won't have that data. We won't be able to track it. Conspiracy theorists will come up with all kinds of ideas about, oh, you know, they wanted to change it because they don't want good data and they don't want to see it. I don't think that's the case. It's not like there aren't other surveys out there. I just think this is terrible timing. It's like, why could they have not done this a few years ago, or why could they not do it a few years from now? Why could they not find some way to ask all the questions, the old and the new questions, so we can track the old data while still moving forward with new and better questions? You're going to probably see a lot of discussion about this. This will inevitably, every time they come out with a new number, you will hear a lot of people screaming conspiracy. They're trying to bury the data, or they're trying to skew the numbers or do something else. I don't think it's that at all, but I do think it's poor timing, and I wish that there was some way to keep collecting data the way that they have been for decades, I think, but they're changing the questions, and it'll be interesting. We'll have to use different sources moving forward.
Folks, if you're listening right now and you've entered the exchange, you've bought a new policy because of the Affordable Care Act, if you think your policy has gone up because of the Affordable Care Act, join the conversation, 866-994-6343. We want to hear your experience. If you've got any questions, Dr. Aaron Carroll is joining us, and this is, in a way, a public service. He is an expert on health insurance and health policy. Also, is really good at health in general, debunking myths all the time. My daughter has a what looks like a bug bite on her shoulder, and it hurts. It's got a little tiny circle around it, but that happened right away. And you know where we live, and the one of the worst areas for Lyme disease. So we're all scared and paranoid about that right now.
Yeah, I mean, you can have a doctor look at it, but you know that the vast majority of bug bites don't.
I don't even know if that's what it is, but it hurts her. It's like on the back of her shoulder.
But it's all with ticks. I mean, is it a tick? Isn't Lyme disease almost all from the tick? I mean, this is, again, yeah, not my area because I'm not there, so it doesn't sound like it's a tick bite. It sounds like she had a bug bite.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I think it might be like a spider or something.
Yeah. So, but there you go.
Don't need to worry about
diagnosed
it.
Over the phone.
No, oh, God, that's very unprofessional. 866-994-6343 is the phone number to call. Join the conversation. I've got to get to Carl Lester's question. He said he emailed you, but he hadn't heard back. That's not your responsibility to return every email. But I figure I would I'd ask him. He says, "Dear Dr. Carroll, I currently get my health insurance through my employer, but I'm changing jobs. My coverage with my new employer won't start for 30 days after I start. Will I be subject to a penalty because I will have a 30-day gap in my insurance coverage?"
No. He will not be subject to it. But none of that is all of that is beyond his control. So it will not matter.
Says, "I can't afford to pay COBRA coverage during the gap. Can you please explain if there's any consequence to me?"
I don't want to say 100%. So I'll look it up later. But I am reasonably confident that no, because if you try to do the right thing, and this is what you're doing, and you basically have the coverage, but it doesn't kick in, and it's because you lost coverage to the old job, that's not how the employer, I mean, the individual mandate's going to, it should work. So he should not be penalized for that.
Let's go to, can you say penalize and not penalize?
I don't think either one is right or wrong. So no.
No, penalize is better. It sounds like you're saying penisalized.
No, that's only in your head.
Armando in Texas, you're on Stand Up.
Yes, Dr. Carroll, I have a question for you.
Sure.
I live in Texas, right close to the border.
Mm-hmm.
My spouse is a Mexican national,
okay,
and we've been declaring our taxes with his ITIN, which is tax identification number, so that he's taxed and we declare our taxes as if he were a real citizen of the United States.
Okay.
However, next year, is he going to need health insurance? Because I can't get an answer to this from anybody.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he needs to have health insurance, even though he can't come across. He has no visa. So he's going to be buying insurance if he
She's your wife?
No. First of all, back up. So here's the thing. If she is not a citizen of the United States, then none of this applies because she's not even allowed to buy insurance in the exchanges. Again, you know, illegal immigrant, and I'm not saying she's an illegal immigrant, but I'm saying, in other words, if you try to be in the country and you're not a legal immigrant, none of this applies as far as I know, because they made it expressly impossible for such people to buy insurance on the exchanges. So if she is not part of the United States, then no.
Okay, I know that. Okay. The problem is that she's got an ITIN, which is income tax identification number.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's treated as if he were a legal resident for tax purposes.
Right.
Okay? So for tax purposes, does he need to buy insurance or no?
I think so. God, you know, that is so specialized as a question. Again, I would want to check that out for myself. Email me, because I don't even like no. I'm going to guess no, though. I can probably put you in touch with someone who might be able to answer that question. But
isn't she your wife?
No.
My
husband.
What?
He's my husband.
He is your husband?
Yeah.
You're a man?
Yeah.
Well,
can't tell, right?
No, I can tell, and your name is Armando. No, but I mean, I don't know if that changes anything.
No, I don't think it's legal purposes. He's asking a question about tax law, about whether,
right,
because he's like declared on the taxes or filing.
They're, but they're not even legally recognizing his marriage.
I'm not arguing with you, but still, he's not wrong. And in fact, but he's asking a reasonable question in that he's if he's recognized on the tax.
Yeah, my marriage may not be recognized in Texas, and I don't care. However, the federal government does recognize it, and I'll be filing federal taxes. I just want to know if I'm going to be penalized or not.
Right.
Also, because taxes are where you're supposed to declare whether you have insurance, and that's where the penalty
is.
So it's like that. Yeah. That is a reasonable question. It's interesting. I don't know the answer.
Are your parents more upset that you're gay or that you're with a Mexican, Armando?
No, my parents are Mexican to begin with.
Oh, all right. Same question, though.
No,
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. That's a really interesting question. And hopefully Dr. Carroll will be able to get back to you.
Yeah, but I can probably try to find someone who can help you, that question is not like in the standard, you know.
All right, we've got two questions answered, one by email and one on the phones there by Armando. Look who it is, the guy whose Twitter handle I have written on my desktop, at Mario J. Russo. I always pronounced it Mario, Dr. Carroll, but Mario has reprimanded us a number of times.
Thank you, Pat. I thought you meant today. I didn't know what you meant. But
no, I mean Super Mario. Has anybody ever say Super Mario?
Other than grandparents?
He's straight from the other side, though.
Who?
It's Mario.
It's the plumber.
He's from Brooklyn.
What?
He's from Brooklyn.
Yeah,
the Mario Brothers.
Mario Brothers are like Brooklyn.
No,
they are?
Yeah,
but I feel like, hey, you guys know they're not real. Like, they can't be from a place.
I feel like Mario is like saying my name is Andrea instead of Andrea.
Right. Or Michelle versus Michelle.
Alfred.
Calm down, Alfred. Yeah, exactly.
Backstory.
What's that, Aaron?
Just because they're fictional characters does not mean they have a backstory. Or that.
Ooh,
everybody...
wow.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I hit a real sore spot with Captain Comic Book right there. Go ahead.
Aaron. Thank you, Aaron.
Mario, you're on with Aaron.
And Alfred. Aaron.
And Alfred. I'm Petter.
Speaking of state insurance commissioners,
okay.
Do on federally facilitated marketplaces, who is in control of fighting back against insurance spikes?
Well, it depends. I think that's still done. Great question. I think that it depends if they're in the exchanges or not. And I also think that it's mostly going to be originally done at the state level, but I'm sure it can get up to the federal level. But if the exchanges, of course, are being run by the federal government, then they would be the ones that would have to take care of it as the plans would have to submit it to the exchanges in the federal, and the feds are controlling it.
Okay, so it by so in Texas, I'm concerned about unfriendly ACA state who, well, the state insurance commissioner will go along with, you know, gigantic spike hikes.
But I think they gave up control. If they give it up to the exchange, if they give it up to the federal government, then they have to submit all their paperwork. It's being run by the federal government. That's who makes the decisions. I believe Texas is one of the ones that gave it up. So,
That's how it is.
Mario.
This, by the way, just so you know, this is why, of course, the local states originally fought for local control. They thought that they could really have a big hand in this.
Right.
And most of the conservative states were the ones that truly wanted local control. This was the big thing originally. It's ironic that in their sort of efforts to just have no, they don't want their hands on it at all, they've given up local control. And it's gone back to the, it's the exact opposite of what little c conservatives usually want. They have released local control to the federal government.
Yes. So
at Mario J. Russo, everybody. Tweet him there. Tell him how his name's pronounced.
Aaron, let me ask you one other question, quick question.
Go ahead.
What is the number one remedy you would prescribe for...
Oil of oregano.
No!
I knew you were going to say that. What's the number one thing you would prescribe for cutting our spending in health care?
So if I had my way,
you're the king.
I probably would implement a pretty rigorous
death penalty
of no of now you see it distracting me. I can't remember what I was going to say. It was
wow.
Oh, it's killing me. It's the insurance where basically you decide how much you're going to spend based on quality and evidence. So in other words, if something works, we pay for it. If something doesn't work, we don't pay for it. And if something works as well as something else, we pay whatever the cheapest amount is. It's I've written on this 1,000 times, and I swear to God, the
look
word
at you getting stumped today.
Eluding me, the word is eluding me, but it is a well documented, studied form of insurance where basically
pricing?
You're paying by quality. So in other words, if there was medical therapy and surgery, and medical therapy had the exact same outcomes, we'd say we're going to pay that amount. If you want to pay the extra for surgery, feel free to pay the extra, but we as insurance or we as the government are not going to sink in unlimited money. Same would go for drugs, same would go for anything else. And when things have been proven not to work, we would pay very little. So instead of just doing across-the-board cost-sharing of 25% or whatever number we pick, which is just how we do things now, we would have much more of a decision based upon, you know, what works and what would be the most, you know, effective way of doing it. And I think there's a lot of what we do which has no good or really doesn't work as well or better than stuff that is much cheaper, and we don't acknowledge that, and we don't try to make decisions. Now, I'm not
one example.
Okay, I mean, the one I always use is that, you know, in 2003, there was a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine where there's a, you know, people have osteoarthritis of the knee. And it has existed for a long time. And a lot of procedures were being done called arthroscopic surgery. They basically, you know, go into the knee, they sort of clean it out, and they sew you up, and they send you on your way. And in 2003, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, they did an actual randomized controlled trial. And I have no idea how they got this through an IRB, but they took a whole group of people with osteoarthritis of the knee. Half of them got the procedure. The other half, they put them on the table, they cut them open, they twiddled their thumbs, they did nothing, they sewed them back up, told them they had the procedure, sent them on their way. The people that got nothing done did exactly as well or basically no difference than the people that got arthroscopic surgery, meaning arthroscopic surgery does not work to improve symptoms or improve the quality.
But that is only for certain knee, in this case, knee
issues.
Stop.
Let me finish. So, of course, the surgeons went crazy, and they repeated the study, where this time they compared arthroscopic surgery to just getting medical therapy. And what they found out, again, was medical therapy works just as well as the arthroscopic surgery. So now we have proven in two different studies that this surgery doesn't work. We spend like $1 billion a year, if not more, on this stuff through Medicare.
But there's
arthroscopic surgery for arthroscopic. And that's one thing. $1 billion.
It's so funny that you mentioned it, because my brother sent that study, found that study. He's considering knee surgery for himself.
Mm-hmm.
My mom is getting knee surgery, I think, this week. He saw that study, and this week when we were together, he mentioned it. My mom and dad were both talking about it. One of my dad's good friends is a orthopedic surgeon, however. And so my mom's going through with it, but my brother mentioned that study. It's so funny that you mentioned that one in his research that he found. Yeah.
And I talked to orthopedic surgeons, and a lot of them will say, like, yeah, we know that. Like, they know it. But, you know, and a lot of them won't do the surgery anymore. A lot of surgeons won't. But we spend from Medicare like $1 billion a year.
We should get.
Why? Why do we do it? Why do we not say, you know what, we'll pay for the medical therapy. If you want the surgery, this is America. You are welcome to go pay for it. But we're not going to because we've proven it doesn't work.
Right.
So at that point, you know, and there's a lot of things. Choosing Wisely is a campaign that we've talked about on the show many times where they identified all kinds of stuff we just shouldn't be doing. But we do it and we pay for it. And that's low-hanging fruit.
There you go, Mary.
Do you ever think we're going to see a point where we actually...
All right, that's the third question. I want to get to Tina.
Okay, goodbye.
Well, hold on. You can stay on with us. I love Mario. And Tina, you know Tina. Look at this. Melanie, everybody, ladies and gentlemen, at TM Winsett, calling the program. It is our honor to welcome one of our favorite listeners and followers on Twitter. Just love her, at TM Winsett. I see your tweets. You're on the air with Dr. Aaron Carroll, Tina.
Value-based insurance. Oh, my God, it just came to me. I'm sorry, Tina. Value-based insurance. That's what I was talking about.
Wow, somebody did not have his oat brand this morning.
Exactly. That is not
early.
Good. Value-based insurance design.
It is early.
I don't know how y'all's brains work this early anyhow.
Hi, Tina.
Well, I was just, since we talked about it several times over the last few years, I was just going to very quickly give you an update. I had a real quick question for Dr. Carroll, but I did finally get my daughter and I insured on the exchange.
Hey, that's great.
Yeah, I'm falling into that no Medicaid expansion gap in Texas where my personal income, I'm long-term separated, but divorce isn't final, so I'm still, you know, attached with my ex's income for that. So that, you know, it's just a personal situation there. But even if we were divorced, my personal income is way too much for Medicaid in Texas, but not enough to hit the subsidy level.
Right.
Because the support, my daughter is nonverbal autistic, so I'm working from home, caring for her.
Mm-hmm. And
so
your mom.
I have to work as a social worker. Yeah, and my mom with dementia. So I'm in that
cares for
in
cares for both her daughter up. And her mother. Amazing woman, Tina. Go ahead.
The support my ex pays for my daughter doesn't count towards income. So although, you know, I'm in a middle class income level just barely because a big chunk of that income doesn't count, leaves me out of the subsidies. So that said, I had, you know, when I got on the exchange, I was able to get a policy even without subsidy for my daughter and I both for about $250 a month less than what the Texas high risk pool was for just me. And we've got, I now put the dental on it too. And then when I looked at going a very similar policy bought straight from the insurer with still about $130 a month less getting it through the exchange.
Right.
So even though it doesn't work for me on, you know, one level, because this is going to be a huge chunk of my monthly income.
I believe it.
For me, you know, to go. But having been without insurance for 9 years, it's, you know, important that we do it. And
sure.
Given that I have good financial support from my ex, we're going to be able to make it work. You know,
it is just ironic that if you just made a little bit more money, your insurance would be close to free. It is just crazy sometimes how we do policy.
And in all honesty, given that, you know, I have enough educational background and some friends who are accountants, we're actually looking at what I can do to make a few changes in my catering business and some things I can do, you know, to legally get my income into that level.
Well, do it. I mean, if it's, you know,
well, we will.
If you can find a way, do it. Because, I mean, it's all legal. It's all craziness.
Can we help? I don't know if we'll be any help. Tina, where do you live?
I'm in a suburb of Houston.
If you live in or around Houston, the name of your company and people can buy your baked goods and whatever else you sell is what?
Tina's Treats.
You have a website?
I don't. I've not. You know, I it's
how can people give you their money for your treats?
You know, I've had great word of mouth. The community I live in has been amazingly supportive and just pure word of mouth over the past few years.
Tina's Treats is a suburb of Dallas, right?
Houston.
I'm sorry, Houston. I'm not a good listener, as you know, Tina.
Yeah.
A suburb of Houston. Well, you have to include something about me, and I'd be all over it. Tina's Treats.
Have you seen pictures of her desserts? They look incredible.
They're amazing looking. Yeah. And Tina isn't.
Mom and my grandma taught me to cook and bake because going back to work as a social worker just isn't viable and, you know, caring for my kids.
Very special woman who's been listening, following, tweeting, and we love you, Tina, and I hope people will buy Tina's treats in Dallas. Well,
Dr. Carroll's info has been just absolutely crucial for me in navigating all this past year and figuring out what I could do and how I can do. What I am really curious about is why do so many of the policies on the exchange have such incredibly high deductibles?
Because that's the way that they keep them low, with premiums low.
Yeah.
And there's two reasons for that. One is that they do need to come up with, you know, bronze, when they do silver, when they do, mm-hmm. you know, gold and platinum, they explicitly set actuarial value. So the bronze are 60% actuarial value, meaning that they expect you to pay for 40% of costs. So they have to keep the deductibles high in order to make the 40, you know, the 40% work, because obviously if they had low deductible, they wind up paying much more of it on their end, and that would classify it as platinum. So sort of by definition, the deductibles in the bronze and silvers are going to be high. The second reason is that the subsidies don't apply a lot to the out-of-pocket payments. And so, you know, if people buy a lot of bronze plans or silver plans, the subsidies, it's like that, you know, then the government winds up paying less money because they don't have to pay for all the out-of-pocket. You know, they only have to pay to help you cover the premiums. And so there is some cost-sharing and stuff, but it's less than the bronze. And so, you know, people buy the bronze plans. It saves the government and the CBO projections and everything else money.
I do have to say I really was, at least for the county I live in, I had a huge array of plans to choose from. And, I mean, there really was everything from ridiculous deductibles. So I ended up with a policy with a family $5,000 deductible, which for us, been self-employed, you know, with my ex and, you know, everything for years. So we've been on the private market for years. When we lost our insurance after my breast cancer diagnosis, it had gotten to a point where we had a $5,000 deductible per person.
Yeah.
You know, on our policy. So, I mean, when people, you know, these high deductibles are not new, and I completely understand
you know,
that.
Again, it's the only sort of one of the few anecdotes I use, but my parents, who, by the way, my dad's not a big fan of the Affordable Care Act, you know, until he got to Medicare, his plan had like a $15,000 deductible.
Mm-hmm.
My mom's had like a 10 or a 5, I mean, just insanely large numbers, you know, or maybe it was, did it cost, but it was a $10,000. I mean, there are very, very large individual deductibles out there.
Wasn't there a report on your website regarding the difference between the exchange deductibles and pre-exchange, and it was relatively comparable?
Yeah, I mean, deductibles are still very high. They've been very high. This is what always blows me away when you hear conservatives screaming about how what really needs to be there to fix health insurance is high deductible health care plans. It's like, oh my God, like, where are you? Like, look at them. They're everywhere. You know, the plans that we consider quote unquote comprehensive have enormous deductibles. And so it is just bizarre. But high deductibles are not new. They certainly exist under the Affordable Care Act. They will continue to exist, and they don't seem to be doing much to make everybody thrilled.
And I just wanted to say, for people who are, you know, still skittish about the exchange and dealing with it, although enrollment's closed now, people can do the, you know, life changes between now and November. But when November rolls around, I have to say I had unbelievably great customer service. My situation is just really complicated, and trying to do some of it online just myself, you know, just wasn't. I needed, you know, the rep. So, and I had 3 different phone calls over the course of 3 months, I was on the phone a total of 6.5 hours.
Wow.
Over those 3 phone calls in trying. And I was just seriously amazed at all 3 people I spoke to, amazingly professional, really helpful, you know, and just completely, you know, literally just night before last, you know, finished everything up, and her, you know, walking me through, going through plans, trying to figure out what made the most sense. Because there really was a really wide, there were some non-deductible plans.
Super complicated issue. It's good that you can have people walking you through it, people that get paid to do that. I bet you, if you could, you would have sent them some of Tina's treats.
Most definitely. I did definitely do the survey call this last call with her because she was amazing.
Oh, very nice.
Definitely. So,
who gives back more than tuna?
A sigh of relief. I mean, yes, I'm nervous about, you know, in my situation, paying this monthly premium because it's more, you know, than what I'm really comfortable with my budget. I'm a little nervous. It's going to mean I'm going to have to cut back on my daughter's autism therapy a bit. But that's nothing compared to 9 years of no insurance and worrying all the damn time that my cancer was going to come back or my daughter's, she had seizure disorder, which thank goodness she's not had a seizure at all in 4.5 years, hasn't been on meds for 3. But, you know, it's always in the back of your head. Okay,
sure.
If that comes up again, because I spent 4 years trying, you know, every month to figure out how I was going to pay for her seizure meds, which were ridiculously expensive, you know. So it's, you know, I know a lot of people have a lot of problem with the ACA, but people just need to be honest in our medical system. There's just so much we need to do to make it better.
Yeah.
Tina, thank you. Everybody follow Tina, at TM Winsett. Her tweets are great. She's constantly taking in media. She's super, super intelligent and great at filtering all the BS. We love you. Thank you for your call. Mario, what would you like to say to Tina?
Tina, it was unbelievably great to hear your voice and put a voice behind the awesome tweets and exchanges we've had.
Big part of the family, Mario and Tina. I've seen both their names on tweets. Guys, thank you.
Bye-bye.
You guys are the best. Thanks.
All right. There you go. At TM Winsett. WINSETT, and at Mario J. Russo, who's far less important of a follow and a man, but both of them often tweeting together. I've got to take a break. We'll come back with at Aaron E. Carroll, 2 R's, 2 L's, and lots of great questions. 2 lines just freed up, 866-994-6343. Call with your questions about the Affordable Care Act, debunk medical myths, and more with the great Dr. Carroll, who joins us for the hour today and almost every Wednesday in the third hour here on Stand Up. We'll be right back.
Pete wants you to know he was once an accessory to a crime. A friend vandalized a mailbox. He feels bad about it. Stand Up with Pete Dominic.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Dr. Aaron Carroll joins us for the remainder of this hour, and I'm headed out to see him. Indianapolis, Indiana, I'm coming tomorrow. Morty's Comedy Joint, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night. Dr. Carroll will be there with me. Meet us both. Get a picture and an autograph. Not from us. Just get a picture and an autograph from somebody else. Bring it to the program. Whose autograph would you want to get or have you gotten, Dr. Carroll? And then we'll go back to the phones.
I'm not a big autograph guy.
But you did when you were little. You got one when you were a little boy. You got somebody's autograph.
The best one I think I ever got was I got Reggie Jackson to sign a lot of my baseball cards and some baseballs.
Uh-huh. I got Mark Gastineau to sign 12 different items for me, former New York Jets legend.
Nicely done.
Yeah, that was before he beat his wife. But he has since really reformed and found Christ.
I'm glad to hear that he's reformed.
I bumped into him on the street last year. And told him that when I was 12 years old, he really made my day, my year, by getting to meet him and sign. And he started crying.
Aww,
he was so happy
He
was so happy that a 38-year-old came over and told him about 12-year-old, the 12-year-old version. It was a sweet moment.
So nice.
Yeah, I walked past him on the street, and then I turned around. I was like, you know what? And I ran back because I knew it was him. I didn't want to bother him, but you know what? I got to tell him what he did for me when I was 12. He was just very moved. I mean, generally, people are very moved when they meet me, as you know.
Right, then they learn the truth.
Kevin in D.C., you're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll.
Yes, hi, Pete. Thank you for taking my call. This is actually at Spinal Snap on Twitter, so thank you for retweeting all the U.S. Paralympic stuff as well.
We got to get you on as a guest. Kevin is a victim of a – what are you?
So I had an incomplete spinal cord injury about 6.5 years ago now. So I suffered partial paralysis and chronic pain and things like that. But I've actually made a really great physical recovery. So I cycle and do things like that to raise money for spinal cord injury research and cures for paralysis. So we'll have a ride later on this year. I'd love to come on and discuss it a little bit at some point.
Absolutely. We like to trade fathering stories as well. Kevin's a great dad.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And my question for Dr. Carroll, and thank you for always doing this. I've learned a tremendous amount from this. I've been involved in bedside healthcare and industry healthcare for about 15 years now. You had discussed a potential insurance plan where we would sort of decide based on best practices what we would pay for. I've oftentimes seen studies that will contradict each other, or you may just have healthcare professionals that are in one camp or another when it comes to medical devices, drugs, different therapies, and things like that. Within that plan that you proposed, who would be making the decision, and how would that decision be made as to sort of what studies to listen to, or what factors would go into the decision making to say, okay, we are going to pay for this, we aren't going to pay for that, in a medical era where there's a lot of conflicting opinions on what does work, what doesn't work, what sure. journals to listen to, what not to listen to. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, like, the way I would start is, again, I would say low-hanging fruit. Like, in other words, like, look at the Choosing Wisely campaign, which you can look up right now, where they pick the stuff where people have stopped arguing. You know, it's like where there's this is general consensus, where like each doctor's organization, you know, comes out with their own five recommendations. So the orthopedic doctors and the orthopedic society says these are five things we all agree. So it's not these are doctors for the most part doing this, but there's doctor organizations. The American Academy of Pediatrics does some, American Academy of Family Practice does some, and like, you know, and if everybody puts this out and says these are things we should really, for the most part, should not be doing. And if insurance companies tomorrow implemented those decisions, or we just said, you know what, we've all agreed we should not be doing this, it causes more harm than good, and they just said we're not going to pay for it anymore, which would really, really be to get how to stop doing it, we would save billions and billions and billions of dollars a year. And so that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about low-level tricky stuff where there's hot debate. It's the stuff that's easy. The stuff where it's like where doctors and organizations themselves say we should not be doing this. Like, in other words, what if I said tomorrow, like, we will no longer pay for antibiotics for viral illnesses, which everybody knows you shouldn't do. It's on news stories every day, yet we still do it. What if we stop paying for it? If we said tomorrow, like, we're no longer going to pay, that would save us a ton of money just because people would stop doing it. If it stopped being free. This is the whole theory, by the way, behind co-pays and high deductible health care plans and more skin in the game. It's the idea that if individuals have to pay for it, they won't use as much. That does work. The problem is right now the way we do it is we make people discriminate between necessary and unnecessary care, and they're bad at it. But there are many times when we collectively can totally identify the unnecessary care. And if we said we're not going to pay for that anymore, it would result in a significant amount of savings, and it would probably improve outcomes too, because when we have stuff that does no good, then it can only cause harm. And so we'd wind up probably eliminating some of that harm too.
Value-based insurance, choose wisely. Kevin, great to hear your voice on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for answering the question.
Sure.
Yeah, and be in touch with me. I would love to get you on to talk about your injury and everything else surrounding it. Jim is in Texas. You're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll, 866-994-6343. Time for a couple more calls, questions, comments, arguments, while we've got the good doctor. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I read on the web yesterday, so it must be true, that the change in the survey questions on the census would start picking up data in 2012 prior to the onset of the exchanges. We would capture that change.
No, it's going to pick up 2013. So we'll pick up 1 year of stuff before the exchanges kick in. And this is like how some people are defending it. And I say, okay, but you know, it's not just exchanges that I care about. It's a lot of the other policies that we're doing, some of which, you know, kicked in like 2012. And I'd like to know how are they doing. And, we would like to know what is letting kids on insurance. How does that affect? Well, we won't have any more longitudinal data. That's just going to stop. Plus, in 2013, maybe it'll take some time for them to figure out the methodology. Or, you know, what if 2013 turns out to be an aberrant year because of the economy, and therefore we don't know whether the changes were because of the economy or because of the Affordable Care Act? We won't be able to say, well, let's wait a year or two so that we can compare, or look back a year or two so we can compare how things did with different levels of the economy. We won't be able to control for anything. We will have one point of data for the pre versus years and years and years of data that we could try. This is not the end of the world. I don't mean to say that, like, we're not going to be able to do this. There are other data sources. This is not you know, going to destroy our ability. But it is bothersome to me as a researcher that, and not because I suspect conspiracy, but just I'm annoyed that I will lose the data, that the sort of most accepted metric for measuring the uninsured will just unfortunately be unavailable to us to look at how things worked before 4 years and after 4 years the Affordable Care Act went into place.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Jim. I've got a question, Dr. Carroll. You've answered many questions twice, three times, but I want to go back to there's an argument that folks on the right like to make about saving money. One way to save money on insurance, the cost of insurance, would be to allow insurance companies to sell their insurance across state lines. You've talked before about that they would just congregate in the states with the least regulations and sell from those, and that's an issue. But I think one of the most important arguments against this comes from, I believe it was Alabama or the state that tried to have to do this. Insurance companies didn't want to do it. So it was a weird instance where people were arguing for something on behalf of an industry and the industry itself said, no, thanks, but no thanks. We're not interested. Is that right?
I don't know exactly what happened in Alabama, so I can't answer. But here's the thing, a state in and of itself is not going to, you know, if one state says, hey, we'll let you do this, it's not going to work anymore. First of all, it can't because of the Affordable Care Act, because they just can't buy crappy insurance. And you have to realize, when you're talking about selling across state lines, you're asking insurance companies to either just want to cover the healthy people, because why would they go looking for sick people across state lines, or they just want to sell really cheap policies, really crappy policies where there's no risk for them. Both of those ideas are now illegal under the Affordable Care Act. They can't cherry pick. They can't get into the exchanges. In order to any company, by the way, that wants to go sell insurance to other states is totally welcome to do so. They have to go and they have to like meet with the individual exchanges and they have to figure out, you know, how do I comply with the state laws? How do I do all that? So, you know, there's just no way for, I think, Alabama to just do that. I'd have to read the story. I can't think of a good way that Alabama could just by itself right now just say that we're going to allow that kind of law.
Ralph in Ohio, you're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll.
Yes, I just want to make a comment about the Unaffordable Care Act. Huh. The one thing I like about it is the fact that it makes the recipients, like Dr. Carroll said earlier, have some skin in the game. Unlike all these other entitlement programs where all these recipients have zero accountability, no dogs in the fight, none of that, at least the Affordable Care Act makes them pay. And because of that, that's what I feel is going to help get them Democrats out of office in 2016.
What makes you say that it's unaffordable? Because without it, we would be in far worse shape.
No, I think, if my own opinion, I think the free market was doing just fine. There were plenty of other ways to...
By what metric was the free market doing fine in terms of covering, in terms of coverage, in terms of affordability?
No,
in terms of giving
people the choice rather than having the government tell you what you can and you can't do. That's the thing I don't like about it, period.
What does the government tell? Okay. Well,
I don't answer the question. The question, though, was what was doing great before? This is the thing. It's like you can't
answer the question. The fact that it was an individual choice.
But it wasn't a choice.
Government out here forcing people to do things. If grown, healthy people want to walk around with their insurance, with no insurance, that should be their choice.
It is their choice. They can still do it.
Other people shouldn't have to pay for it.
No, but they don't. Healthy people today do not have this is the mistake. They don't have to get insurance. You are welcome not to get insurance.
Yeah, and you have to
pay a penalty. You're right. You got to pay a tax. You got to pay a tax. The United States taxes exist, but no one put a gun to your head and made you buy insurance.
Well, no, the government is He got that gun. So he's making you put your skin in the game. And that's what these people ain't used to. They're used to having things handed to them. And that's exactly why.
But when you say that it was working well, I mean, it's just there's so many different ways.
I want to back up. Let's just take Tina, who called like 5 or 10 minutes ago. How did she not have skin in the game? And how was she having an entitlement when she was trying to buy insurance but then being refused a policy by insurance companies because no one would cover her because she had been employed, lost her insurance because she lost her job, so she lost her insurance. No other company would give her a plan, even if she was willing to pay for it, because she'd had breast cancer in the past. How is she asking for a handout or, you know, not have skin in the game?
Well, hey, it's all kind of holes in the system, and people are falling through cracks.
Yeah,
and I'm not an insurance expert, but and the little I know about the political system and social issues in this country, I just feel like people in a free country, which this is supposed to be, should have their choice whether they want to.
But you can feel that way, but the evidence and the data is something different. So the question always should become to someone like you, as a critic of a policy like this, is why should Europe have way better outcomes in terms of affordability, in terms of coverage, people that are covered, and in terms of quality? Why should they have way better outcomes by those three metrics and cost far less than in America? They're far happier, by the way. They're way happier there in general because they know that in the worst-case scenario in their life, if they lose their job, they're not going to lose their health care, and they know they're not going to go bankrupt because of medical bills. Why can't we in America, quote, the freest country in the world, enjoy that as well at a lower cost? Why not?
Well, because, number one, it's a lot of contributing factors. One is the fact that they won't secure these borders. We got 12 million undocumented or illegal people living in this.
Why not let them buy insurance? Those illegals, why not let them buy the product, Ralph?
Back to where they come from.
But hold on, Ralph, we are. More than ever, we are. Why not let them buy? Illegal immigrants can buy cigarettes, beer, and anything they want. Why can't they buy insurance? Wouldn't you rather have someone who's here illegally be able to have coverage so that you wouldn't have to pay for their costs in the emergency room? Don't you agree with that?
Well, you know what? I think it was pretty much not necessarily taking care of itself the way it was before.
Why not let them buy? Why not let illegal immigrants buy insurance?
Yeah, and I just told you Tina's story. It wasn't working before.
Yeah, he's not listening. It's weird. He said he doesn't pay much attention to it. All right, well, we'll have to end on that note, unfortunately. But fine, that's fine. Dr. Carroll, I'll see you tomorrow.
You got it.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
All right, @AaronE. Carroll on Twitter. Give him a follow. Thank him and all of our guests.